From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 130,000 troops deployed in Iraq, 130,000 American families celebrating Thanksgiving without a father, son, brother, mother, or sister, as more soldiers pack their bags to go. The troops in Iraq leave behind children, spouses, and parents who depend on them. And then there's Afghanistan. Tonight on Point, on the eve of Thanksgiving, an intimate conversation with the families of American soldiers at war. We begin in Washington with an update on the forces in Iraq and their families back home. Esther Schrader is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her to describe the profile of the troops now deployed in Iraq.
Right now, we have a total of about 130,000 U.S. troops in Iraq and many more in what the Central Command calls the Area of Operations, supporting the effort there. It bears remembering that for every combat soldier on the ground, there's a long logistics train of soldiers that are supporting those people. Those are the Jessica Lynches of the world who get the supplies, and in some cases don't get the supplies. But when everything goes right, they get the supplies to the soldiers on the front line. And many of them are Guard and Reserve troops for just that reason, because they are logistics people and they are supporting this combat soldier. But since we're in a low-intensity insurgency, all of these people find themselves in danger. And that is one of the problems and questions that the U.S. military is grappling with as it goes forward, how to best protect its people when many of the people who are there are not normally accustomed or trained to be in a combat environment. However, in this particular instance, almost everywhere in Iraq has to be considered a combat environment.
Is it possible to generalize about how long people have now been in Iraq? What's the range? How long have most of the U.S. military out there been there?
You may recall that not too long ago, it was announced that troops serving in Iraq would go in on 12-month rotations. Not all of them stay 12 months. None of them have stayed longer than 12 months. And here I hesitate because in some very unusual instances, they may have. And many of them stay for somewhat shorter period of times. But right now, the force is stretched to the extent that many, many of these folks who expect to go normally for a 6-month rotation are going for 12-month rotations. And we have not done rotations that long in these numbers since Vietnam.
But as we talk today on the eve of Thanksgiving, my understanding is a lot of soldiers have been there since the invasion.
Many of them have. Now, some of those folks came home the last few months and are coming home now. But the impact on them and on their families is extraordinary. You talk about this holiday and what comes to mind are the number of families and soldiers, of course, who will not be together. These are people, in many cases, quite literally, who didn't sign on for this.
You're talking about the Guard and Reserve there, National
Guard.
Yeah,
I am. And you really have to talk about them because when this newest rotation is completed by May, 40% of all of the troops in Iraq are going to be Guard and Reserve.
Now, this is the rotation that's supposed to ultimately bring the total number of U.S. troops there down to 100,000, but with a very heavy Guard and Reserve element.
Yeah, it's actually about 108,000,
okay.
Because just today it was announced that 3,000 Marines and assorted other troops have been mobilized by the Secretary of Defense.
What stories are you hearing, Esther, about how Reserve and Guard families and deployed troops are handling this?
I was at Walter Reed Army Medical Center for a story recently and was very moved to talk to a U.S. soldier in the Alabama National Guard who is in his 50s, who was terribly wounded, who had just gotten a Purple Heart. It was his second Purple Heart. He got his first one in Beirut because he was in the American Embassy bombing in Beirut. And he wasn't complaining, but he did tell me, listen, I used to be in the Army. I got out. I got into the Guard to supplement my paycheck. I didn't get into the Guard for this. You know, he wasn't bitter. He wasn't complaining, but he was very honest. And I think that's the situation that you see with a lot of these guys. when they signed on the dotted line, maybe it did say that this could happen. But that wasn't the Garden Reserve as it has been functioning for all these years.
It's happening in a big way right now. What about morale and equipment in the field? We've heard stories on both fronts. What have you heard?
The Pentagon says that there is no quantitative difference between the equipment they provide the Garden Reserve in the field and that they provide troops. The Pentagon acknowledges that they are short of new protective body armor, armored vests for all of their troops in Iraq. They're short of heavily armored Humvees for their troops, and they're short of anti-missile systems on helicopters for all of the troops. It is most definitely true that they lack the protective equipment they need to deal with a counterinsurgency. We are not used to equipping our forces to deal with the threat of terrorism on every front, every day.
Esther, it's at some point the morale issues came to a head and the military decided to let soldiers come home for two-week leaves. How's that working out?
Well, I profiled one of these families and talked to a lot of people on this, and I think that overall, they're grateful for it. It helps a little bit. It causes a whole other set of issues, and adjustment problems for the families while they're back, and then readjustment to them, to dad and, you know, your wife, your husband not being home again. It is not easy and has not been easy for these families. It's a welcome development, but it really is looking a lot like a desperate move on the part of the Pentagon to stave off more broader and more easily trackable morale problems that could be in store in the future.
Esther Schrader, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Esther Schrader is Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with us from Washington. We look forward to Thanksgiving for its turkey and stuffing, its tangy cranberry sauce and warm pecan pie, and for catching up, slow and unhurried, with family. For the families of many American soldiers, this year's celebration will be more somber, filled with thoughts of loved ones in Iraq and Afghanistan or on the way there soon, and the long separations ahead. Tonight on Point, we'll hear from four American families living intimately with war. Four families with loved ones spending this Thanksgiving in Iraq or on the way. Do you have a husband, a sister, a brother deployed in Iraq tonight in Afghanistan? What do you hear from them? How are you managing without them this Thanksgiving? And what do you want to say tonight to the families of soldiers under fire in Iraq? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Columbia, Kentucky, is Trina Miller, whose husband, Wendell, left for Iraq in May. He's a sergeant and team leader in the 217th National Guard Quartermaster Detachment out of Danville, Kentucky. He works on water purification north of Baghdad in the city of Balad, in the heart of anti-American resistance territory. Trina and Wendell have been married since 1991 and have a 6-year-old son and take care of a 7-year-old niece. Wendell is home on a 2-week leave right now. He heads back to Iraq on Tuesday. Trina joins us tonight. Good evening and welcome, Trina Miller.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for being with us. Also with us tonight from Madison, Wisconsin, is Kelly Bradley. Kelly and her husband Shane were married in January, just a few days before his National Guard unit was mobilized. He left for Kuwait on March 21st. He's a first lieutenant and pilot in the 147th Command Aviation Battalion out of Madison, Wisconsin. He flies Black Hawk helicopter missions over Iraq from his base in Kuwait. Good evening and welcome, Kelly Bradley.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being with us. Trina Miller, if I could to you first. Wendell is home. He's been home for a week and a half now. He's been out there for a long time. How is he? How do you find him?
He's doing great. He's still kind of in military mode, but he's really doing well. Excited to be home.
How are you spending Thanksgiving, Trina?
Well, we've had tomorrow will be our second Thanksgiving. So he has a large family, so we spent Thanksgiving with his family on this past Sunday, and tomorrow we'll be spending it with my family. So,
with your family, and I understand that the men in the family go rabbit hunting on Thanksgiving.
Yes, they do.
And that tomorrow, your son Isaiah, who's six years old, it'll be his first time to join the hunt.
Yes, yes.
A good day to have his father around.
Yes, exactly.
Trina, how much notice did you get that Wendell would be coming home for a 2-week leave?
Well, he told me about 2 weeks before that he was set to come home on that date, and we tried to keep it a secret because, you know, we didn't know if it would get canceled, and we didn't want to let our son know to get his hopes up, maybe, you know, with the possibility of cancellation. So Isaiah was told just a couple of days beforehand.
So not a lot of notice, but you're glad he's home.
Exactly.
But he's also headed back on Tuesday, I'm sorry to remind you.
Yes, that's true.
Kelly Bradley, I'm sure tonight you'd be, I guess, just only too happy to have Shane home. How long has he been in Iraq now? 6 months or so?
No, 8 months, Tom.
Eight months. Okay, pardon me. I'm sure you're counting.
That's okay. He left the day of Shock and Awe, actually, March 21st, and he was home on his two-week R&R leave October 1st through the 15th.
So you got to see him.
Yes, which was wonderful.
How did you find him? Trina said, and I'm sure it's true, for many of the men and women coming home on these leaves, that's a heck of a transition from the kind of circumstances they're in Iraq to the bosom of the family again. How was it when Shane was home? Could he soften up and really be there with you, or was he holding the, you know, battle-ready posture?
Well, like Trina said, it first few days it was really still military mode, but he really got back into the swing of things at home, and, you know, he just wanted to grill out and have a beer and, you know, lay around and watch TV and just relax. So it was great having him home. He even got right back into the chores and took out the garbage and stuff like that.
That's a good man. That's a good man.
Yeah.
That's a good man. How much longer do you expect that he'll be in Iraq?
Well, we're looking at a year, boots on the ground. So hopefully March they'll be home. We still don't have a date yet.
Kelly, can you describe his missions in Iraq? He's based in Kuwait. He flies Black Hawk helicopters over Iraq. Is that right?
Right. He does fly in Kuwait, but he also does fly north. Mm-hmm. So they do mostly carry troops, high-ranking officials and things like that is what mostly they do. They're a command aviation battalion.
Since he returned to Iraq, there have, of course, been these awful, very high-profile shoot-downs of helicopters. What's Shane telling you about how he's avoiding that?
Not much. I've asked him before, you know, what do you guys do? And how do you avoid these things? Or, you know, do you have, you know, anti-aircraft missiles on your, you know, that you can shoot out the flares and things like that?
The wife wants to know.
Yeah. Well, he said, you know, they have the capabilities to do that stuff. He doesn't really tell me exactly what they have, but he doesn't talk about it much. And he said they don't talk about it much at the unit either. I think it's too hard.
It must be because I suppose in some sense there's only so much they can do about it.
Right.
And Trina, how do you deal with your son Isaiah, 6 years old? How does he understand what his father's up to in Iraq?
Well, he understands that he's there supporting other troops and that they need that support while they're there. It's when you think about a six-year-old, the comprehension. But he's proud of his dad, and he knows that his dad's there doing his part. And you to see the pride in a six-year-old is just amazing. Talking about his dad.
Wendell works in water purification, but he carries a gun to do that, and we can well understand that. What's your sense in talking with him of the danger level that he faces going to and from the work he's doing there?
Like, he doesn't. He only tells me certain things. He knows that I worry. Like, if he's going traveling, he won't tell me until he's been there and back already, and with all the trouble with the convoys and stuff, so that you see on the news, he doesn't tell me that until he's already back to where he's centralized at. So.
That's a merciful husband, but we're sure that you're watching and watching closely.
Exactly.
Trina, Kelly, please stand by. We're going to be joined by some more voices in just a moment. We're talking tonight with soldiers' families. On the night before Thanksgiving, about living with war in Iraq. Do you have loved ones deployed in Iraq tonight, in Afghanistan? What do you hear from them? How are you managing without them? And in all the talk of strategy and timetables, do we overlook the direct burden of soldiers and their families? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 800-282-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with soldiers, families on the night before Thanksgiving about living with war in Iraq, living very intimately in their case. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you want to say to the families of U.S. soldiers deployed tonight in Iraq or Afghanistan, for that matter? Can you imagine an empty chair at your Thanksgiving table where that young man or woman, and sometimes not so young in the National Guard and Reserves, is deployed overseas? Will there be an empty chair at your table tomorrow? Can you imagine having a husband, a wife, your child in the war zone? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Madison, Wisconsin, by Kelly Bradley. Her husband, Shane, has been in Iraq since March. And from Columbia, Kentucky, by Trina Miller. Her husband, Wendell, has been in Iraq since May. He's home for a short leave right now. He'll be there Thanksgiving tomorrow with Kelly's family, his son, Isaiah, out hunting rabbits in Kentucky. And good on him. We wish him good hunting there, but he'll be back, headed to Iraq on Tuesday. I'm joined in the studio now by Pat Taylor. Pat's son, Bill, left for Kuwait on November 6th. Pat Taylor, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
It's very good of you to be here. Tell us about your son, his military affiliation, and how he ended up in Iraq.
My son, Bill, graduated from West Point in 1996, went to flight school at Fort Rucker, and became a Black Hawk pilot. He's now stationed at Fort Drum, and he was told this summer that his unit would be deployed to Iraq sometime in the fall, and he left on November 6th.
He's a captain in A Company, 2nd Battalion, 10th Aviation Regiment out of Fort Drum.
That's correct.
Arrived in Kuwait, and his next stop next Wednesday is?
To Crete.
Saddam Hussein's hometown.
That's correct. They are in Iraq and will be moving further north after that. For now, in Kuwait, they're retrofitting the helicopters with Kevlar floors and more armor.
And we know why, because they've been taking a lot of fire.
Yes.
Pat, Bill was home for an early Thanksgiving with you, am I right?
Yes. We knew he was leaving in the fall, so we decided we'd better have Thanksgiving. And on October 23rd, we had the turkey and stuffing and all the fixings. And it was a great celebration.
You've known for some time. I mean, Bill's been in the Army, and this was his career. Has it come as a surprise, a shock? How are you actually taking on board the fact of him now going into a very difficult situation? How are you handling it, Pat?
Well, this summer, when the other units in Fort Drum were sent to Afghanistan, we felt that we were lucky, and that we might, you know, not have to deal with deployment. And then it was only a matter of a few weeks later that they said that his company would be leaving for Iraq. It's very difficult. It will be a very stressful year.
12 months, that's what you're expecting?
That's what they were told.
And what's your expectation of how you'll hear from him? Has he told you? Has he talked to you on the phone already? Does he have that access?
Well, thank goodness for email, because we have received no letters. And his wife has gotten phone calls, but he's told her that sometimes the wait is over 2 hours to get to a phone. The line is so long.
We can just picture it. You've got a son who really is a thinker.
Yes.
As I understand, he'd like to ultimately be a professor of military history at West Point.
That's true. He's already sent his applications for grad school, hoping to enroll in fall of 2004.
But the thing he's doing right now is not about libraries and graduate degrees. It's about the hard work of war, as the generals there say.
Yes. Many of the people who teach history at West Point are part of the history that they helped make. So he's carrying on that tradition.
Kelly, what about your communications with Shane in the field? How often do you hear from him? Do you get letters? Do you have anything you could share with us?
Well, we're pretty lucky in the fact that he can call pretty frequently. So I do talk to him about every 3 days or so. But like Pat said, thank goodness for email, because that's how we primarily talk. We actually spoke this afternoon, Shane and I, and we got cut off. So everything is, you know, and then he emails me while they're working on the phones and they're going to be down the rest of the night. So, you know, it's frustrating, too. And in the beginning, when he first went there in March, it was really, really hard to hear from him on the phone. You couldn't, there's always an echo. So like as I'm speaking to you right now, I would hear myself speaking back,
right,
you know, on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So in the beginning, it was very hard, and it's gotten better.
Trina, how is it? You've got two kids at home and Wendell so far away. Give us a sense of just the practical challenges of making a family work with a husband in the National Guard suddenly whisked away for such a long time.
Well, you have to have a routine, and you have to have support, whether it's from your family, your friends, and those are the things that get you through that day. I mean, you're constantly thinking about your husband and worrying about him, but yet you work full-time, you get the kids to school in the morning, deal with those daily things, problems that come up, and it's all you can. I mean, it's what you have to do. There's no other way to do it.
How are you bearing up? Do you have days when you just say, good Lord, I can't do all this?
Oh, yes. There are those days when you come home and there's water all over the kitchen floor and you can't find the main shut off. It's like, what do you do? But, you just deal it, and you're sitting there, water running everywhere, and you're crying. But you manage it. You have no other choice.
You really don't, I guess. I want to welcome one more voice into our conversation tonight. Tricia Thompson is joining us from Concord, New Hampshire. She's a sergeant in the 744th Transportation Company in the National Guard, mobilized as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. She herself is leaving for the Middle East on December 12th. Good evening and welcome, Tricia Thompson.
Good evening, sir.
Thank you very much for joining us, Tricia. You're 32 years old. You're a corrections officer in New Hampshire. You're in the National Guard, and you're called up. Do you know exactly where you're headed?
I do not.
We can well imagine it may well be Iraq, given all the news out of the Pentagon lately. An awful lot of deployments are headed there. Are you prepared for that?
I believe that myself and my unit have been trained properly, and I think we're ready for the challenge.
How do you picture what your work's going to be, Tricia, when you're ultimately deployed into the field, wherever it may be? Give us a sense of what you do with the transport company.
Well, our main job is to get supplies to where they need to go, no matter where it is. And the mission has to happen no matter what, and there's a lot of challenges in that in itself. Everything from dealing with vehicles breaking down to roads being closed. You just have to adapt and overcome.
I know that in being called up, I mean, people have responded to the call-up in all kinds of ways, especially since it's become clear that these are long deployments and often dangerous deployments. The responses have been quite varied, but my producer tells me you're really proud that your unit's been called.
I actually think it's a great honor that we've been asked to step up and take this task on. It says a lot for our unit, says a lot for our state and how we've been trained and the confidence they have in our unit.
And what about the human side of it, Tricia? You've got a 13-year-old stepdaughter that I think you're fairly close to. You may not see her for a year. What's the cost there?
I'm going to miss out on a lot of things. I mean, she's due to have her braces off in January. I'm going to miss her first day in high school. I'm going to miss a lot. It's going to be tough. I believe email is going to be my best friend as well as writing letters. I'll do everything I can from taping messages to make it more personal to send home. But it's going to be tough.
Does she have a sense that you may well be in Iraq? You may well be in the middle of the news she sees on television?
We've talked about it in a pretty great deal. She's not very open to talking about it.
13 years old, yeah.
Yeah, she has a lot of support, though. Her best friend's father is going with our unit, so they have something they can share and lean on each other.
We're talking tonight with soldiers' families about living with the war in Iraq. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Jennifer's calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling. I'm the daughter of two Army colonels. I was born while my father was deployed in Vietnam. He didn't see me until I was 9 months old. Mm-hmm. And then my stepmother was deployed in the first Gulf War in 91, and she was also gone for 9 months. And, of course, it was very hard on the family. But I was very struck by the comment that the reporter made earlier in the story about the gentleman who's in the Guard who got a Purple Heart and said, you know, this is not what I signed up for. You know, I signed up to supplement my pay. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he signed up for. He signed up to shoot and to be shot at. And although I feel certainly sympathy for people who are away from their families, people in the Guard, people in the Reserve, and all active duty volunteers, there's no draft anymore.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, we've got it. And it's an interesting point that you raise, and a particularly acute one in this war. I want to try and pick it up with our guests. Thank you for your call. Trina Miller, let me turn to you on that. You know, this is kind of touchy because on the one hand, yes, when you sign up for the National Guard, this is part of the package. It's not even the tiny fine print. It's right in there. On the other hand, we know that thousands and thousands of Americans have signed up and have seen it as kind of a weekend warrior thing, have looked at it as supplemental income. This is the first year-long deployment of such troops since the Vietnam War. That's a long time. Have you and Wendell been kind of taken aback at the demands being made here, or did you fully expect that they might be this heavy?
He knew, and I both knew, that this is a chance that you take when you sign up. That, you know, we've been through this before with Desert Storm, and, you know, like she said, they volunteer, they sign that agreement, they know that this is the chance that they take, and these soldiers, you know, the gentleman that made that comment with the reporter, you know, some people may feel that way, but, you know, you're not forced to do this. This is a volunteer, and the soldiers that are proud to serve their country, and this is what they do.
We don't doubt that pride, but I just wonder in your heart of hearts, when you talk with your best friends, if you don't feel sometimes like, gosh, I didn't think it would be this long, this heavy, this dangerous a deployment that Wendell would face.
Last time it was 9 months that he was gone. And, you know, you look forward to that day when he's coming home to stay, but this is part of it. You know, it pains me to say that, but to think about the possibility that he may not be home until next May, it's just overwhelming to think about that. But you deal with it. You work through it. All you do is sit down and cry because, you know, you're there by yourself. Mm-hmm. Your best friend is over there risking his life. But you just deal with it. It's part of it.
Kelly Bradley in Madison, Wisconsin. I know you actually work for a magazine that goes out to Wisconsin Army National Guard members, a magazine called At Ease for members and retirees. So you must be in touch with and aware of a lot of sentiment in the National Guard. Help us span these views. On the one hand, people sign up for the National Guard and they know what that may entail. On the other hand, you heard the reporter Esther Schrader, who had spoken with a severely wounded guardsman in Walter Reed Hospital, who said, you know, this wasn't exactly what I thought was on the line. What's the range of response that you're hearing from guardsmen in Wisconsin?
Well, I guess I've been hearing one word over and over and over again, and that's predictability. We need to know a date when they're coming home. And my husband's unit left, and they mobilized about 200 soldiers to Kuwait. In September, about 160 of his unit came home, and 45 or 43 are still there, my husband included. Splitting a unit up and not giving them a date to come home is the problem. And, you know, they really need to do that. And I've heard, you know, I work for the Wisconsin National Guard, and I've heard our own generals say there needs to be predictability. And you cannot mobilize Wisconsin National Guard soldiers, or any National Guard soldiers for that matter, for up to 18 months of active duty service. They are employed, civilian employed. Their families are, you know, they are pulled away from their families, their jobs, and it's different from active duty. So,
but they are being called up for up to 18 months, aren't they? Isn't
correct.
That
correct? They are now
12 months
correct.
In the field, 18 months overall.
Correct. Yeah. When my husband was called up, it was 12 months on active duty, and in the middle of his deployment, they changed it to 12 months boots on the ground. However long beyond that.
Why do you think there's not predictability in this case, Kelly?
I don't know. I don't know. And that's a lot of questions. I just got an email from a wife the other day. She's got a 4-year-old and a 4-month-old. And she said, all I want to know is a date. Just tell us when they're coming home, because we don't even have a light at the end of the tunnel right now. We have no date when they're coming home.
That's tough. A lot of rotation going on, and we hope that your husband, Shane, gets back in that. Pat Taylor, you fairly well know you're expecting a year.
Well, they said there would be a 1-year deployment, but optimistically we hope that it would be less if there's some change in the situation.
It would be great. We have people here, Tricia going out, Trina and Kelly with spouses there. For you as a mother, what's the sensation? Did you always know that your son was going to be a soldier? Did you know early on? How did you feel about that?
Well, he was the only 8-year-old boy in his neighborhood who made parachutes out of hankies, tied them on the G.I. Joes, and threw them out of the bathroom window. So pretty early on, it looked like he was going to be involved in this. And as he was in high school and said that he wanted to go to West Point, he definitely made the decision to commit to the military life.
And how closely do you follow the news now coming out of Iraq, knowing that he's headed in?
Yes, no, I follow it every morning, the first thing I do when I get up, because they're 8 hours ahead of us in time. When I get up in the morning, it's their middle of their day, so that's a good time to see what's happening that day.
And what do you think about the direction that the war's taking?
Well, I haven't really thought much about that, because I'm just involved in it as a mother. And I just sympathize with all the other mothers and fathers and wives across the country, because not from a political point of view, but from the point of view of the commitment that all these soldiers are making.
Do you feel supported?
Yes, I do.
By the country, by your friends, by your community?
There's a support group that I belong to of moms. We call ourselves military moms. There's 20 of us, and it's mothers of Marines, soldiers, National Guard, and reserves. We meet every Monday, and we just feel really good about what our children are doing.
Military moms and dads and brothers and sisters and kids tonight with family in Iraq, in Afghanistan. We're talking tonight with soldiers' families about living with the war in Iraq. You can join the conversation. What do Americans owe the soldiers and families directly bearing the burden of the war in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with soldiers' families on the night before Thanksgiving about living with the war in Iraq. You can join this conversation as well. What do you want to say to the families of U.S. soldiers deployed tonight in Iraq or maybe in Afghanistan, another 10,000 there? What about your family? Will you be waiting tomorrow for a call from Baghdad, from Tikrit, from Balad, from Mosul, from Kabul? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Do you have loved ones deployed in Iraq tonight? What do you want to say to the families who do? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Pat Taylor, her son Bill, Army captain, arrived in Kuwait, or left for Kuwait on November 6th. He will be headed next Wednesday to Tikrit, hometown of Saddam Hussein, from Columbia, Kentucky, by Trina Miller, her husband Wendell. Left for Iraq in May. He's home right now on 2 weeks' leave. He'll be back, headed back to Iraq next week, December 2nd. From Madison, Wisconsin, Kelly Bradley, her husband Shane, has been based flying helicopters, Black Hawks, out of Kuwait. And I think I've got that. That's right, isn't it, Kelly?
Yes, he's in Kuwait, but he does fly into Iraq.
Flying into Iraq. And with us from Concord, New Hampshire tonight, Tricia Thompson. She will be headed out herself in a National Guard unit, leaving on December 12th. Parts unknown, very likely Iraq. She'll serve in a transportation unit. You can join the conversation as well, 1-800-423-8255. Kelly, I wonder if you've got any correspondence you can share with us from Shane that might give us a flavor for his thinking or his days in Iraq and Kuwait.
Yes, I have two different emails from him. The first one is dated November 22nd. Here in Wisconsin, we just have had three active duty people that were killed in the latest Black Hawk crash. One of them was a lieutenant like my husband, about the same age, and just recently graduated from Fort Rucker Flight School like my husband. Mm-hmm. And I asked him if he knew him, and he wrote back, "I don't know any of the people that you mentioned below or the people that went down in the Hawk crash. We aren't talking too much about those things, not for any specific reason. I guess it's just not good conversation material." So I don't think they really talk about it a lot. Yeah. The other email is kind of funny. He had a guy named Pat with him from his unit who had a new camera, and he says, "We flew from here at Udari all the way up to Baghdad, my first time, and back today. I logged 7.1 flight hours today. Crazy. Wow. I had Pat with us. He had his new camera with him and snapped some pretty cool shots. We saw some camels on the way back, and he wanted to shoot them. So we went back and flew low circles around all the camels so he could get footage." He thought that was pretty funny. It was kind of a good story.
If you're shooting, bringing home pictures of camels in the Iraqi desert.
Buzzing the camels.
You'd rather have him doing that, I think, than just about anything else. Jerry's calling from Montreal, Wisconsin. Hi, Jerry, on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Jerry, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. I just like to say my heart goes out to the parents and the mothers, fathers, everyone. I just feel absolutely terrible at the situation that they're in. I don't have any relatives or anything who are over there. I don't know anybody over there, but I watch the news continually, and it's just a terrible thing that we've gotten into there, I think. I just feel bad for the family, and especially at the holiday times, it's just tear at their hearts.
It can't be easy, but you hear them bearing up. And Jerry, we thank you for your call and for your appreciation to our guest tonight. Keith is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Keith, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just want to ask everybody there, because you have family members that are actually over there now, and how your actual political views, outside of the fact that, you know, you support your troops, obviously, how the political views on whether or not you feel that America has a right to actually be in the Middle East.
We'll take it straight up, Keith, and thank you for your call. Pat, let me put it to you first. It's hard to have politics when your son's in the field, and yet you're a citizen like the rest of us. What do you think?
I think that one of the greatest fears that I've heard from the soldiers, be from my mother's support group or from my son, is the fear that no one cares that they're there and how dedicated they are and what they're doing and how hard they're working and what great risk they're at and what sacrifice they're making. And they're so afraid that the people of America are not behind them 100%. And I think that irregardless of what political views I or anyone has, that we've got to just continue to support these soldiers.
And your son's among them. Trina Miller in Kentucky, let me put the same Keith's question to you. Do you support the American effort in Iraq? And to put it more pointedly, Keith says, does the United States have a right to be there? How would you respond?
I agree with Pat. It's the troops, you know, they feel that, you know, my husband, he's so afraid that a lot of times people's political views lean to not supporting the troops, even, you know, no matter what, these troops are doing their jobs and they need the support of the American people. My husband, he sees the children there that if, you know, they don't have the rights, they don't have the freedoms, you know, that our children do. They don't have the privileges that we do. And that's the importance that he sees in that, in his being there. That is the difference that he's making in the lives of those children that are going to lead this country in 20 years,
mm-hmm.
that's the importance that he sees.
And Kelly, let me put it to you. We hear a fair amount of support for troops, but what about the policy? Do you think the United States is right to be there?
Well, I don't know about their right and stuff, but I when my husband was home on leave, I asked him, how do you feel? Do you think we should be there? Do you think we're doing the right thing? And when his unit first got there to Kuwait, their job was to transport high-ranking officials and different people like that up to sites of weapons of mass destruction and also mass grave sites. And he said to me that when you see those mass grave sites, you know why you're there.
Tricia Thompson, last to you. What do you think about the whole effort? As you head out very soon to quite likely become part of it, are you confident it's the right thing to be doing?
Well, honestly, the only thing I can really say is I support my commander-in-chief, and I support all the fellow soldiers in my unit and all the units that are there.
Simple as that?
It's that simple.
I'm sorry to say it, but we're out of time. It's so good of each of you to share your thoughts and a moment in your lives with us tonight. It's important for us to remember exactly the sacrifices that are being made out there. Tricia Thompson, we wish you very good luck in your own deployment.
Thank you, sir.
Pat Taylor, good luck to your son, Bill.
Thank you.
Kelly Bradley, good luck to your husband, Shane.
Thank you.
And Trina Miller, good luck to your husband, Wendell, as he heads back out next week. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you all, and the very best wishes to your family members and to yourselves. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, looking forward to an imperfect Thanksgiving dinner. This is On Point. The turkey's in the house, vegetables chopped, and the pumpkin pie is cooling on the windowsill. A few more hours in the kitchen tomorrow, and the perfect Thanksgiving dinner will be on the table. That's the storybook picture, anyway. But it doesn't always happen that way. Cambridge, Massachusetts writer Joan Wickersham says she doesn't strive for perfection when she hosts Thanksgiving. In this radio diary, she says it's the imperfections and uncertainties of the holiday that make it special for her.
Years ago, I worked at an ad agency, writing TV commercials for the phone company. The assignment was very specific. Encourage people to make calls to other towns in Massachusetts that were at least 40 miles away. The 40-mile radius was crucial, for some reason I can no longer remember. Maybe that was the distance beyond which the rates went up. The commercials had to show people making phone calls. The calls couldn't involve exciting events, like a new baby or an engagement, because that implied you should only use the phone when something important happened. And it had to be clear that these were long-distance calls within Massachusetts. We didn't want to promote out-of-state calls, because another carrier handled those. Oh, and the spots had to be heartwarming. We ended up with ads that went like this. Hi, Mom. Even though I've grown up and am living halfway across the state, 50 miles away from you, I just felt like calling to say I love you. I hated those ads. I was embarrassed to tell anyone I did them. The client referred to them as our slice of life campaign. Whose life? I used to mutter in my office, typing up yet another 30 seconds of generic slop. Real lives are messy, irrational, uncomfortable, thrilling. Events do happen. I knew this as a 22-year-old copywriter. I know it even better now. So why do I expect my Thanksgivings to be like phone company commercials? I want a perfectly roasted turkey, a crackling fire in the fireplace, affectionate conversation, pies that don't fall apart when you cut them. I want cliches. I want everyone to be happy, grateful, relaxed. I want to say, let's go around the table and each say what we're thankful for and not have everyone roll their eyes at me. Have I ever had a Thanksgiving like that? A picture-perfect holiday? I don't remember. The Thanksgivings I do remember are the uncomfortable ones, the oddballs. Like when I was 5 and my father took me to the Macy's parade. He held me on his shoulders, and I held on to his ears so I wouldn't fall off. The morning was freezing. The trombones were so loud they made me wince. Vast balloons loomed overhead, straining ominously at their cords, tossing in a sudden gust of wind. I shivered and cowered and stared. It was terrifying and wonderful. Or there was the year my husband and I bought our first apartment. It was a huge stretch financially. We were happy, but scared at having taken such a leap into adult responsibility. We decided to celebrate Thanksgiving in the new place, even though we hadn't moved in yet. The empty apartment slowly filled with the smell of roasting turkey. I'd brought over my grandmother's melon-colored tablecloth, washed and ironed so many times that it was smooth and supple as silk. I spread it on the floor and set it with the silver forks and knives my other grandmother had given me for a wedding present, which her parents had given her for a wedding present. The apartment had a view of the Charles River if you stood at the farthest corner of the living room window and tilted your head very far to the right. We stood there looking out at the November twilight. When the dinner was ready, we sat on the beautiful cloth, ate our picnic feast by candlelight, and felt at home. 4 years later, our first child was born, the weekend before Thanksgiving. On Monday, we came home. Chaos. Baby equipment everywhere. Plates of food we didn't have time to finish. Crumpled gift wrap that we pulled off presents but never put into the trash. Our son would wake up and start to cry, and we didn't know if it was hunger or colic or a wet diaper or an infected umbilical cord, and by the time we had fed him and changed him and soothed him, it was time to do it all again. My parents called and said they'd like to come for Thanksgiving. "Fine, fine," I said. I hadn't thought about dinner. I hadn't planned anything. "Don't worry," they said, "we'll bring something." They arrived on Thursday morning with a cooler. My mother sat with me in the living room and fussed over the baby. My father went into the kitchen and cooked. He roasted a turkey, topped and tailed green beans, made gravy. He never came out to ask where the ladle was or which dish he should use for the stuffing. He found everything. He just did it, and then he got it all on the table. He had even dug out the melon-colored cloth, the silver knives and forks. We pulled the baby carriage into the dining room. The baby slept. We ate this generous, unexpected, perfect gift of a feast, and I felt blessed. The first Thanksgiving wasn't a celebration of predictable contentment. The Pilgrims had already struggled through one wretched winter. They were appalled by the climate and the difficulty of working the soil. Yes, there was a harvest, but it wasn't much, and another winter was coming. So they bluffed. They took a day off to give thanks. They snatched a few hours from a chaotic, scary, unpredictable existence to be grateful. They pretended that they felt settled and that everything was fine. I've been scared at a lot of Thanksgivings, of a noisy parade, of a big mortgage bill, of a new baby whose fragile life was in my care. Still, it's easy for me to fall into the trap of imagining that the perfect holiday is free of baggage. No pressing work deadlines. No anxiety over a friend's depression. No ache of missing my father. No turkey that really takes 6 hours to cook, even though the pop-up thermometer popped after four. But then I'd end up with a perfect turkey, and "I love you even though you live outside my local calling area." No thanks.
Joan Wickersham is a writer living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.